in South Africa and elsewhere, I would like to add. I'm still under the spell of yesterday's concert by Huma Zekela, yesterday's keynote by Njabulo Ndebele. We got great insights. I imagine that if you have already joined us yesterday night, you are tired of opening speeches. There were many yesterday. But on behalf of Haus der Kultur in der Welt, of our staff, of all the forces that we have joined to bring up this symposium, I want to warmly thank all the participants that made the long way from South Africa to here, some of them on very short notice, and we are very thankful to Nomonisa Gaza, who will step in this week on behalf of us to replace Christina Kunta, who was originally invited. What we expect from this symposium is an open discussion. So there is not going to be a succession of speeches, but an open discussion. We are very curious to enter this conversation, to get your insights on how to critically assess this 20 years of democracy, on how to reset the agenda on four key areas: economics, education, justice, and public culture. When we started preparing this symposium with Erik van Grasdorf and with a lot of other friends and advisors, we immediately saw the relevance also for other countries to discuss South Africa as a test case. Let me add that as a personal remark, when we prepared the applications, I happened to be in my home country in Argentina, where we were just commemorating 30 years of democracy. There were riots on the streets, there were people getting shot by police, and I was personally having this back and forth between remembering how strong and young we felt when from one day to the other, the old regime had no power and a lot of people that could make your life hard or painful were not danger anymore. And at the same time, looking at the upheavals and the critical situation that is undergoing the country now. And when I started working on this festival, on this symposium, I always had this global South perspective in my mind. This is not going to be the central issue. We want to talk on South Africa, but I imagine that for many of the participants, also other democratic experiences will resonate, and we are very interested in this context. So yesterday, Mr. Ndebele had one line that struck me. He said, we built a lot of houses, a lot of housing projects, but we did not consider how to build a community. And, well, that's one of the issues we want to start talking with. And I'm happy that Julia Reimer is going to coordinate, moderate the next round. So welcome, Mr. Corvo, Mrs. Gaza, Mrs. Reimer, Ms. Reimer. And yes, we'll have a short Q&A later. And a full program, you can see it in the program leaflets. Thank you.
Ganz herzlichen Dank, Silvia Fehrmann, hier vom Haus der Kulturen der Welt. Ja, mein Name ist Jule Reimer. Ich bin hauptberuflich Redakteurin beim Deutschlandfunk, das zum Deutschlandradio gehört, also mit seinen drei Sendern Deutschlandfunk, Deutschlandradio Kultur, den die Berliner wahrscheinlich auch besonders kennen werden, und die Radio Wissen. Und ich freue mich sehr, dass ich hier moderieren kann bei einem Panel oder auch bei einem Festival, was wirklich eine beeindruckende Riege von führenden intellektuellen Kulturschaffenden aus Südafrika hierhin eingeladen hat. Ich persönlich, das wollte ich vorausschicken, habe sehr, sehr viel Respekt vor dem friedlichen Übergang, den Südafrika geschafft hat, zur Demokratie hin, nach den ganzen Ereignissen, die dem vorausgegangen sind, jahrhundertelange Unterdrückung, sehr viel, ja, auch Brutalität, Grausamkeit seitens der Sicherheitskräfte, die Apartheid. Wir haben an der Ukraine gesehen, wie schnell Staaten, die vielleicht auch in einer fragilen Situation sind, wo eine Situation völlig außer Kontrolle geraten kann oder fast außer Kontrolle ist. Das heißt, dass so etwas friedlich geschieht, ist überhaupt keine Selbstverständlichkeit. Ich möchte Ihnen die Gäste hier vorstellen. Zu meiner Rechten Nombo Nisogasa. Sie ist Politikwissenschaftlerin an der Uni Kapstadt. Sie hat in hoher leitender Funktion in der Entwicklungsbank in Südafrika gearbeitet und ist dort immer noch einer der Direktoren, wenn ich das richtig verstanden habe. Sie hat den Vorsitz der Südafrikanischen Kommission für Geschlechtergerechtigkeit gehabt und sie hat sehr viel geforscht zu Themen und gearbeitet zu den Themen Identität, Demokratisierung in Subsahara-Afrika und eben insgesamt zum politischen Transformationsprozess in Südafrika. Herzlich willkommen. Zu meiner Linken Nzukizi Kobo. Sie sind Professor für internationale politische Ökonomie an der Uni Pretoria. Sie sind auch oder arbeiten auch als Unternehmensberater. Sie haben im Wirtschaftsministerium, im südafrikanischen Wirtschaftsministerium, die strategische Ausrichtung der Handelspolitik erarbeitet. Zur Erinnerung, die Welthandelsorganisation WTO existiert ja erst seit 1995 und zuvor waren da eigentlich hauptsächlich Industriestaaten Mitglieder. Das heißt, viele Länder, viele Entwicklungsländer mussten sich eigentlich erstmal dann danach neu orientieren und ihre eigene Außenhandelspolitik formulieren und aufbauen. Und er ist auch ein Experte, Sie sind auch ein Experte für die BRICS-Staaten, das heißt also die fünf Emerging Countries, also Schwellenländer, Brasilien, China, Indien, Südafrika und Russland. Und mit Prinz Mashele, einem anderen südafrikanischen Intellektuellen und Publizisten, haben Sie das Buch geschrieben, The Fall of the ANC, wo Sie eine Art Gotthilf-Szenario zeichnen. Zumindest wird es so vorgestellt in der Presse. Und da kommen wir gleich drauf. Zumutungen und Versprechen der Demokratie, das im Bereich Wirtschaft und Gemeinwesen und Zukunftsfähigkeit. Frau Gaza, zwischen 1999 und 2008 hat Südafrika ein beeindruckendes Wirtschaftswachstum verzeichnet. Das war so immer um die 5%. Und dann begann die Krise. Man muss daran erinnern, da begann ja auch international die große Finanzkrise. Heute ist die Arbeitslosigkeit in Südafrika höher denn je. Das Durchschnittseinkommen der schwarzen armen Bevölkerung ist gesunken im Vergleich zu vor 20 Jahren. Und das der weißen Bevölkerung ist gestiegen. Wir haben eine schwarze Elite, die sich wahrscheinlich einkommensmäßig gar nicht so stark von der weißen Elite unterscheidet. Wir werden heute Abend einen Film sehen, Behind the Rainbow von Gian El Tari. Es ist eine Dokumentation über den ANC, über den Weg, den der heutige Präsident Jacob Zuma, der frühere Präsident Thabo Mbeki und Nelson Mandela gegangen sind. Da kommt das Zitat vor: Ich kann Freiheit nicht essen, ich brauche einen Job. Frau Gaza, gibt es Menschen, die sich, also bestimmt nicht die Apartheid, aber die sich irgendwie die alten Zeiten zurückwünschen? War das jetzt richtig übersetzt? Also nicht die Apartheid, aber irgendwie die alten Zeiten?
Is this on? Okay. Good morning, and thank you very much for gracing us with your presence. Firstly, I'd like to correct the bio that was read is not from me. It's very old. I am certainly not the director, non-executive director of the Development Bank of Southern Africa. I haven't been since 2009, early 2009, and a whole range of other things, but that disclaimer is very important. Well, you know, you are taking a quote from a film, and of course, how people imagine freedom is also contextual. I don't believe that there's somebody who wants to be unfree. I don't believe that there's somebody who actually wants to be oppressed. But perhaps the question is, what else does freedom mean for me? And our constitution is very clear that it doesn't have hierarchies. It recognizes the political freedom, human dignity, the what others call second generation rights, but actually I don't know why they have to be second generation, but it recognizes the importance of the well-being of people. It recognizes the importance of people to be able to earn a living, to be able to have those who are not able to earn, to have a safety net that at least cushions them from complete starvation. Our constitution also recognizes the importance of what the so-called third generation rights, that is the environment and so on. So I believe that freedom is a very complex and a very big state of desire that we all want to be in. And a lot of people say that what is freedom if I am unable to eat? But frankly, what is being able to eat when you are not free? And so it is not either or. And I believe that at a certain point, the fact that you're starving becomes more emphasized than the fact that you are politically free. At a certain point, the fact that you are oppressed as a black lesbian and probably face the possibility of being murdered is much more important to you at that particular point where you feel threatened and marginalized. And all these freedoms happen at a continuum of human experience on a daily basis. However, the question is, a lot of people say, we haven't seen any change in our lives. And even that, you know, is not quite true. Because if you look at the state expenditure at a budgetary level, in terms of what goes to a socio-economic development, I know South Africa is called a neoliberal state, but neoliberal, in a classical sense, is a state that has withdrawn and no longer spends for the benefit of its people. So for all the limitations and the problems, there is, in fact, money that goes, that if it were, and this is something that we can talk about later, that if it were implemented correctly, would ensure that no child goes to sleep without food. That intention and that commitment is there, and it is not a choice that it's either the child goes to sleep with food or the child doesn't get education. In the planning, at the planning level, at the conceptual level of trying to imagine what a post-apartheid South Africa would be like in 1993, these things were taken into consideration. The second issue that tends to be elided is that black people's income is lower than in the apartheid era. That is not quite. Statistics don't bear this out. What has happened, however, is that the inflation doesn't match the income that people get. And when I'm saying income, I am not saying that it is acceptable income. And I know that also there are conversations in Europe about what is minimum wage and why are we talking about minimum wage? At which point do we begin to talk about maximum living wage? That income, low as it is supposed to be supplemented by a whole range of services that were not available to black people in the apartheid period. For example, access to health, especially primary health care, access to education, that no child should be denied the right to go to school, for families that are completely unable to have an income, there is what we call a social grant, which again we can also have a whole range of debate about it. I don't think it's a desirable way of handling it, but it is there. It does in some instances offer some kind of shelter, no matter how thin and inadequate it is. I think the critical issue is that when we look at the figures that are allocated in an economy and in an economic system that is, and in a world, in fact, that is not friendly to poor people, and South Africa is part of that. When we look at the figures that go to health and to education and social welfare, housing, all these things, it doesn't make sense that we have people that are starving in South Africa. So there is a difference, there's a discrepancy between the budgetary allocations, inadequate as they are, and what actually goes to these public hospitals. And I think that is a different conversation. So in summary, I believe that sometimes people emphasize the kind of feeling they have at a particular time, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a statement that stands on its own and it obliterates everything else that they are and everything else that they believe. Thank you.
Das heißt, es handelt sich, man muss auch wirklich sehen, inwieweit, sagen wir mal, öffentliche Güter für alle angeboten werden, um de facto die Gesamtsituation zu beurteilen. Herr Kobo, wenn man aber, sagen wir mal, trotzdem Wachstum hat ohne Armutsreduzierung, in China zum Beispiel ist es ja gelungen, Wachstum zu schaffen, wo auch auf breiter Front Armut noch nicht beseitigt ist, aber doch zum Teil auch reduziert worden ist. Wie gesagt, wir hatten 2008 ja auch die Finanzkrise, also das internationale Umfeld war jetzt auch nicht einfach für die südafrikanische Regierung. Aber was ist aus Ihrer Sicht schiefgelaufen?
Thanks. I think it's a pretty complex question. If you look at the long run average growth in South Africa between 1994 and 2012, the economy grew at 3.3% on average. At certain moments, it grew at 5% and was halted by the global financial crisis. An example is often cited, China is often cited as an example of a country that managed to take millions of people out of poverty. And indeed, if you look at the three decades since reforms were unleashed in the late 1970s or early 1980s to 2010, the Chinese government had taken between 500 and 600 million people out of poverty, which means that it is possible to manage social and economic change in a matter of decades. But to do so, you do need a political leadership that is equal to the task. And I'm not saying that South Africa should adopt all the strategies that China adopted. But also, I mean, if you look at one of the Asian tigers, South Korea, which had endured as brutal a colonialism as South Africa endured, in a space of three decades as well, it graduated and became a member of the Rich Country Club, the OECD. The country can find working solutions to transform its society, to transform its economy, and we have to ask questions as well about the kind of economic model that we have adopted. They are increasingly calls globally that perhaps a focus on the GDP is insufficient, and that we need to, in fact, one of my colleagues at the Center for the Study of Governance Innovation, Professor Lorenzo Fieromonti, recently published a book called The Gross Domestic Problem, characterizing GDP as a problem and as having huge limits, that it doesn't take account of other other indicators of well-being, indicators of sustainability. It is less concerned about the quality of life, the standard of living, and whether people are really living sustained and fulfilled livelihoods, but more about the statistical aggregates, that is how much output is generated from an economy. And all sorts of measures can be thrown in as part of the national estimates process. Recently, the United Kingdom discovered that its economy is much bigger than it initially thought because it left out prostitution from the calculations. So the GDP is about national estimates. It's about the output rather than the qualitative aspects. And increasingly, there is a talk about the need to explore different ways of thinking to ensure that economic growth is qualitatively good, but also it is socially inclusive. And the way the South African economy has grown, and Nombonisa is correct here, that if you look at the last census in 2012, it has confirmed that since democracy, the incomes of black households, I think, have grown up about 165 times, which is quite significant. But if you look at the relative measures between groups, the black households' incomes are 1/6 of the income of white households. So there are income divergences between racial groups as well as within races. And South Africa has taken over
as auch innerhalb der einzelnen
mantle of being the most unequal country.
Und Südafrika ist sicherlich das Land mit der größten Ungleichheit in der Welt, eine Position, die Brasilien in der Vergangenheit inne hatte. Es gab Familienprogramme, die in Brasilien umgesetzt wurden, Anti-Armuts-Initiativen sind ergriffen worden, soziale Programme sind umgesetzt worden, Bildungsmaßnahmen, Gesundheitsprojekte und so weiter und so fort, die dazu beigetragen
haben. The value system that we embrace as a society, as a political establishment, as well as sensitivity to issues of inclusiveness. I mean, we're living apart, we're growing apart as society. The black and white are growing apart. We don't quite understand what happens in the other world. And oftentimes, blacks tend to know more about what happens in the white world than the other way around. And the black middle class is pulling off from its original social base, and you have all these divides, these fractures that mark the South African society, and I think it's down to two things in the main. One, it's about the value system. The two, it's about the political finesse, the ability of the capabilities of those we entrust with power to do what is needed to move the economy, to move the economy and the society forward. Thanks.
Ja, vielen Dank. Ein Wertesystem ist aber etwas, was natürlich auch durch politische Parteien beeinflusst wird. Der ANC hat bei den Wahlen immer deutlich über 60% gewonnen. Bei den letzten Wahlen waren es dann 62%. Das ist immer noch eine beträchtliche Mehrheit, mit der man doch eigentlich, ja, würde ich jetzt mal vermuten, den Kurs eines Landes sehr stark bestimmen könnte. Was, ich meine, jetzt hat eine neue Regierungsperiode, Legislaturperiode begonnen. Was glauben Sie denn, ist nötig? Und da bitte ich Sie beide, Ihre Meinung zu sagen und sich vielleicht auch, ich weiß nicht, ob Sie sich da auch vielleicht auch widersprechen. Das war sehr geschickt.
Okay, well, I think my take on the 62%, the fact that, you know, the ANC commands a majority, it is still a hegemonic party, as not quite significant in the sense that, I mean, this reflects a fall in the previous performances, both at the national level, but also when you look at different provinces in South Africa. And I think there is a deep crisis of legitimacy and confidence on the part of the ANC. There are challenges that have been on the rise, but perhaps not sufficient to sweep it off its patch of dominance. But certainly there are cracks that are appearing both within the ANC as well as in the critical institutions in the country. I think I think we are at a place of institutional decomposition in the country. I think there is a feeling, at least emotionally and spiritually amongst some, that the ground is shaking in fundamental areas that we never thought would happen, in the security cluster, in the manner of violence of the police. We've just had 2 years ago the Marikana incident, and that's the most prominent event that has come to the media. Sure.
Darf ich kurz unterbrechen? Marikana war ein Streik, infolgedessen die Polizei eingegriffen hat, und bei dem Polizeieinsatz kamen 44 Menschen ums Leben, davon waren 34 Bergarbeiter. Das war genau vor 2 Jahren im August 2012. Please sure. Continue.
But there are also less pronounced incidents of individuals who have died in the hands of the police brutally, not once, not twice. And there is evidence of a culture of brutality within the police system. There is, you know, the one other key institution, the National Prosecuting Authority, is currently mired in tension, in internal fractures. The opposition parties resort to the courts to get the government to act. There is an over utilization of formal institutions because the informal constraints in the form or expressed in the value systems, in the norms, in the shared understanding of how politicians should behave in relation to citizens have sort of burst at the seams. And all of these is mirrored in the state of ethics within the ruling African National Congress. Okay, just the last point, sorry. Yeah. So in my view, the 62% is not a sign of good health, but it's a sign of decline, and I certainly believe that the ANC is on a sunset, as we argue in our recent book. Thanks.
Frau Gaza, ich möchte Sie bitten, darauf einzugehen und gleichzeitig aber auch noch eben diesen ersten Punkt aufzugreifen. Was würden Sie denn dann in Sachen Wirtschaftspolitik empfehlen?
Well, I mean, firstly, I think that... Would you be so kind? Yeah. Firstly, I think that the story that is not told about the last election and the story that is very important is precisely the story that is not being told. That 62% that the ANC won is less significant than the losses, its decline. We talk about the decline in the metros. There's an assumption that the rural vote, that rural South Africans have not shifted. There's an assumption that they are loyal subjects. They will certainly vote, and they'll always vote for the ANC. In this last election, in fact, the biggest story is that the decline has been seen in rural South Africa. Not a single province has seen the ANC grow in terms of voting, and I'm working with this from district to district and voting station to voting station. Not a single province has seen a growth, including KwaZulu-Natal, which in 2009 had shot up big. It still had a larger turnout than any other province. That takes us to the critical question around representative politics. Because democracy, it is only in recent, it's very recent. It truly is with the American democracy that representative democracy came to be seen as democracy, as the form of democracy. And whether you talk about the PR system, or the constituent system, in any society, you can look at England, you can look at any other society, representative democracy is not sufficient in and of itself. It has to be supplemented by something else. That is the one thing that we need to consider as we are talking about the future. The second thing, again, that I want to read the South African politics from the rural margins, actually. In the absence of alternatives, in the absence of credible alternatives in terms of representative democracy, so what people did, they didn't go to the voting stations. The people that are of voting age, they registered, and they wanted to see who was going to come and who was going to have something that captured them. And in the absence of people not understanding the issues that are coming in the rural, that would affect the rural communities. And this thing of talking to the urban and assuming that you will add rural a little bit. So what they did was that they prepared, they like everybody else, but they could not find, no political party could find, could capture the imagination. Yes, I'm coming to the future. No political party could capture the imagination of them in the context of the ANC that had failed.
Yeah.
And there's a very specific reason why the ANC had failed, that it had relied on traditional leaders. It had started to believe its own rhetoric that if you get the chiefs on your side, that you'll get the vote. So they dropped. Now, where do you go in terms of the future?
Wo gehen wir wirtschaftspolitisch hin? Das wäre mir wichtig.
Sorry?
Where do we go in terms of economical policies?
Sure. So where do you go in terms of the future, in terms of economic policies, is exactly where the ANC is not going at the moment. What you need to do is to take a complete detour from what they're doing. This is what they're doing. In the guise of land restitution to address the imbalances of the past, vast tracts of land, President Zuma actually is the person who engineered this. In February this year, in the National House of Traditional Leaders, he encouraged traditional leaders and he said, put the best resources that you have and get the best lawyers that you can have and claim land for your people. And bring the big land claims so that your people can benefit. So that's one. And this is important for so many reasons. We don't have time to get into this. This is important because the South African economy, agriculture, even though it has declined so much, but agriculture is probably one of the possible areas that we can get into. And we know that so far, if we did a tally of land distribution, the amount of money that has been spent on redistribution and restitution, we would find that the elite, the black elite, are the ones who have been able to benefit the most. They are what are called self-farmers. You see them at the airport and say, hey, yeah, okay, has the inspector come in? Oh, yeah, right. What happened to the sheep? Look, I can't be bothered by that. So that's the one thing. The second thing is that there is a recognition of the fact that mining The contribution of mining in South African economy is, in the healthiest times, it's about 20%. You break that down, 10% is direct into the economy through taxation and so on, and 10% is indirect. You can break it even further down, you find that actually we are fighting about 4.5%. When Marikana happened, many of us, in fact, feared a different kind of Marikana. And to some extent, we can sigh relief, as terrible as what happened in Marikana, but we can sigh a relief that the community tensions between the migrant workers that are employed in Marikana and all these mining communities, that it did not manifest in the way that I still think that it's on the verge in different areas in which it can explode. That in the end, the competition between NUM and the two unions and Lonmin produced the kind of results that you saw. However, there is an underlying tension around the economic policy, and part of it is that, and it's laid bare by the Marikana, by the Falam Commission. When you saw the Deputy President, Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa there, you saw the unhealthy relationship between the state and private sector and politics of patronage. And you saw that graphically. It happens in so many different areas. Now, what do we do in terms of economic policy? South Africa's problem, actually, is not policy. South Africa's problem is imagination. So it's much worse than we think it is. And it is not as if there is not imagination. It is not as if there are no people that are brave enough to think and think creatively around how we get out of things. But it is that where party and state are increasingly being conflated and where loyalty to one faction of the party replaces state institutions as the crisis that in the NDP and so on, that it is impossible to have a process of economic growth. It is impossible to imagine a policy that is concrete. The National Development Plan that we have is a disaster in terms of people that are in the low income wage, because its growth is premised on the understanding that the wages will be kept low. So in fact, what we are having at the moment is going to be an imagined reproduction of the same and the same and the same. Added to that, again, if we were to look at the Marikana as something that gives us a little bit of a prism or the prism through which we can look at what's happening in the rest of South Africa. Before I came here, I was in a meeting of the Alliance for Rural Democracy discussing these land claims. We are having an aggressive relationship between the private sector, between capital from South Africa and elsewhere, that goes in, that wants to extract economy, that wants to extract whatever wealth there is, whether you're talking about mining and quarrying, at the expense of everything and anything else. We talk about Marikana, but there's an older problem that precedes that is not addressed, that is not talked about. The possibility of mining the dunes in the Wild Coast, where there's titanium, it's 2 kilometers stretch in that. The conflict that has arisen out of that is such that in the community, people are not are not attending each other's funerals. The Australian company has come in and has totally, with, of course, collaboration from local partners, has created such incredible tension in that community. So our imagination of the economy is imprisoned by this thing that there's always going to be mining. And indeed there is. The whole land claims, the big land claims, are informed by exploration that is going on in KwaZulu-Natal right now. What it does is that it reinforces a sector of the economy that is extremely extractive but is also destructive, and in fact de-emphasizes other sectors of the economy. So the cost of mining, in fact, is
is so huge in the South African context. What we don't talk about when we talk about Marikana is the fact that 95% of those mine workers who were shot all had, scoliosis, the lung disease. 95% of them. Nobody talks about that. So you and quite a lot of them are men who came from generations and generations of men who had worked in the mines. What we also don't talk about are women who are raped in the mines, who are working as mine workers. So our vision in terms of the economy has got to be a vision that thinks differently about how an extractive economy can handle a society.
Ja, vielen Dank. Darf ich Ihnen das wiedergeben? Naja, geht dazu. Danke. Ich würde Ihnen auch gleich gerne noch kurz die Gelegenheit geben, selber Fragen zu stellen, aber ich würde jetzt erstmal, ich notiere auch, bitte melden Sie sich, wenn Sie Fragen stellen möchten. Ich möchte Herrn Kobo bitten, darauf nochmal zu antworten. Also Landreform, ein wichtiges Thema, ein höchst sensibles. Brasilien versucht seit 30 Jahren eine Landreform zu machen, tut sich da sehr, sehr schwer. Auch gegen den Widerstand der alten Eliten. Simbabwe hat eine Landreform gemacht. Simbabwe geht es wirtschaftlich gar nicht gut und politisch ist die Situation auch kritisch. Wir hatten die äußeren Zwänge, die aus der Tradition des Bergbaus kommen, die Frau Gaza dargestellt hat. Wie viel Spielraum hätte der ANC wirtschaftspolitisch?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think land in any society is a highly contested asset, but you find that land is at the center of managed economic change, whether you look at the Asian tigers in Korea, in Taiwan, or you look even in China, or you look at Brazil. So there is bound to be resistance. In Zimbabwe, there was resistance, and what we later saw as a disruptive process of land reallocation was as a result of a regime that used the frustrations that were genuine on the ground. And the very fact that for many decades, those who held privileged position in society, those who owned land and various assets, did not have goodwill to be proactive about change, to be proactive about transforming property ownership patterns of land ownership, and you may not agree with the tactics that the ZANU-PF adopted in the end, but the issue could have been resolved much, much earlier if there was goodwill on both sides in society. And I fear that South Africa is in the same space because those who have privileges defend their privileges cite partially the utility of education to level the playing field at some point, some indeterminate point in the future. Whereas there could very well be actions and initiatives taken today to change the patterns of property and asset ownership in the country. To some extent, and maybe to a significant extent, I think the ANC government has not used its power appropriately. It oftentimes behaves as if it does not have political power. It gets drawn into areas of activity that have little to do with fundamental economic change in society. So I do think that there is a leeway. It shouldn't happen the way it happened in Zimbabwe. I think we do need to dialogue. We do need to debate in parliament. We do need to conscientize society of the need to equalize the playing field. Government needs to accelerate its program of land reform. There is no need there is no need for it to delay in as much as it has done up to so far. And now with the rise of radicalism from the populist radical nationalist sort of political party that has emerged, the economic freedom fighters, the ANC seems to be on a reactive mode, and I fear that it could ram through policies that are not well thought through as a reaction to a possible loss of electoral support to the EFF.
Und würden Sie auch noch was zur Rolle des Bergbausektors in generell sagen? Could you comment?
Well,
unterliegt Südafrika da großen Zwängen, weil das sind ja alles große, auch teilweise unterliegt Afrika da großen Zwängen? Das sind ja multinationale Konzerne, die sich da engagieren, die womöglich auch großen politischen Einfluss haben.
It's asking very difficult questions. I mean, I worked with mining companies on issues of political risk and investment climate and all of that. My observation first is that mining companies are reluctant to change, are reluctant to make a huge contribution to sustainable livelihoods, to impact sustainable generate sustainable livelihoods amongst those who work for them, but also in the broader South African society. And I would say that some mines have performed better than others. There are mines that have created, that have built houses. There are mines that have given money to trusts that are owned or that are under the guardianship of local municipalities, and such monies disappeared. But by and large, mining companies are, again, there's no strong goodwill to do more. They will tell you that they contribute X amount of money towards foreign exchange earnings, they contribute X amount of money to GDP, they contribute X amount of money to taxes, contribute so much directly in job creation and indirectly. There's also a tension between government and broadly the Anglo-Saxon mining companies in South Africa. And part of the tension is ideological, part is around racial issues, because these companies are believed that they supported the apartheid regime, and they need to do more under the current government. They need to be more patriotic. Government, on the other hand, has not played its role effectively, because you'd recall that in South Africa, the mining order, the mining rights were changed since 2002 from the mining companies, from the mining houses, transferred back to government. So the resources beneath the earth belong to government. The government is a guardian of those resources, and it has licenses that it can use. It can use the license and regulatory mechanism to force transformation. And oftentimes, regulation and the licensing processes is either weak or captured, and sometimes by cronies. So it's you need to resolve this issue at multiple levels. At the first level, mining companies should be forced to play their greater responsibilities. And in fact, if you look at the high income earning corporates in South Africa, these are mining executives, CEOs. They earn on average 145 times more than their workers, and in some instances 725 times. And in the lead, it's your Anglo Gold, Ashanti, Anglo American company, and BHP, bulletin, and then you have the cigarette companies, your, you know, your bad British American tobacco. At the second level, you do need to fix the broken link between the state and business in general, and the mining sector in particular, because they need to fix these problems that we have in South Africa. No one party is going to resolve them. They need to work together. They need to reformulate the roadmap for the long-term development and growth of the mining sector in South Africa. And government needs to use its power, because it does have a leverage in the form of regulation and licensing to force transformation objectives to the mining companies in South Africa. Thanks.
Und es, man muss, sollte vielleicht auch nochmal eben darauf hinweisen oder daran erinnern, dass im Rahmen des Black Empowerment, und man sollte vielleicht nochmal darauf hinweisen, dass im Rahmen des Black Empowerment, Economic Black Empowerment Program, also der Stärkung der schwarzen Bevölkerung, der ökonomischen, auch zahlreiche Vertreter auch des ANC teilweise in diesen Unternehmen eben sitzen, in führenden Positionen. Frau Gaza hat gesagt, sie möchte jetzt noch gerne widersprechen. Ich bitte um kurzes Widersprechen, weil ich gerne dann noch ins Publikum gehen würde.
I just wanted to make, perhaps it's not so much a disagreement. I would, in looking at the Zimbabwean experience and looking at the South African experience, there are also other lessons, actually. And those lessons are not only in relation to the white farmers. They're also in relation to how ZANU-PF handled the land reform and the agrarian program in the first two decades, but they failed. And in fact, there is also a relationship in South Africa that is quite similar to the relationship that ZANU-PF had with the white farmers in those decades, where there's an understanding, a gentleman's understanding, and transactions that are taking place between those who are previously or continued to be advantaged, and the black elite that is coming into power. And I think that is a very important factor, that it was only, in fact, ZANU-PF only started taking a radical position when the veterans were coming in and making, and so there is that danger in South Africa. And I say this because we have not tested the critical institution that we have in South Africa, the critical tool that we have, which is Section 25 in its entirety of the Constitution. We don't know the extent to which, if you implemented Section 25 completely, how far it would take us.
Würden Sie, klar, Moment, das müssen Sie uns kurz erklären.
That is Section 25 deals basically with land, private property, and it does also have provisions for expropriation. And it's very clear what conditions of expropriation and how that should be handled. What we have on land are policy choices, a particular interpretation of the land policy, and we've had this since, the period of President Mbeki. So it's very difficult to even know what in reality are the limitations of Section 25. So there is no political will. The second issue is in terms of mining. Yes, the Anglo-Saxon mining companies are not particularly eager, as you would. It's an extractive and destructive economy. But there's something else that is also at play in South Africa, and it's the entry of the Chinese. I've yet to see an indication that the Chinese are going to be different from the Anglo-Saxon. And in my view, and also evidence is there that shows that the special relationship that the Chinese enjoy with the state is in fact going to make it even more difficult for the state to exercise whatever influence that it can on the mining. Thirdly, the current proposals on the black
black economic empowerment or broad-based economic empowerment, it keeps changing. If you look at it and you analyze that, you see again another shift that in fact increases the stake of the elites. And mining companies like dealing with the elites. They like having discussions with the traditional leader. Whether the traditional leader in fact has the power to do so or not, they like doing that because it's difficult for them to deal with the community. And I think that another crisis of imagination is coming from the mining community companies. I was saying on Twitter the other day that I wish one mining company could employ me to advise them. If they can employ Shanduka, the company of the deputy president, for 250 a month on strategy, I wish they could employ me for a quarter of that and just show them what it would mean to relate to host companies. Because what you have in South Africa and what perhaps we don't have time to deal with here is that the behavior of the mining companies is no different from the behavior of Shell in Nigeria. It is exactly like that. And that can take us to a whole range of conversation around land ownership and where you assume that land is communally held and it's held by certain people on behalf of others. So oil pumps and all pipes are going to go in your backyard, and as we see in the mining industry in South Africa.
Ja, vielen Dank. Jetzt möchte ich zwei Fragen habe ich aus dem Publikum, die schaffen wir auch zu behandeln. Erstmal hier vorne, Herrn Desai, er ist der Regisseur des Filmes Miners Shot Down, der beschrieben hat, wie diese Situation im August 2012 in Marikana sich zuspitzte und was das Ergebnis war. Diesen Film, den Sie heute Abend hier auch sehen können. Herr Desai. Und later you please give the microphone to the lady with the green jacket. Okay? We put the two questions together. Bitte.
I think...
Stand up, might be.
Yeah.
Yeah? Thank you.
The maybe to try and sharpen the debate, and because the debate is becoming very sharp in South Africa. Just a couple of, one story. Nelson Mandela's memorial service at the big stadium we have in Johannesburg. And it was a very difficult memorial for a number of reasons, but the story I want to relay, I was coming home from the memorial service in the car. And there was someone who phoned in to the station about what happened, the booing of President Zuma. And he said something to the effect, it goes like this: Nelson Mandela sacrificed his life for the nation. President Zuma sacrificed his nation for his life. And this is the very real political crux of the problem. I think we need to confront where is the root of that. And I think it's very clear that what's happened is the amount of wealth in white hands in the South African economy has increased, primarily due to the economic policy our country has pursued. And not only that, it's not the levels of relative poverty, it's the levels of inequality that have risen between those who don't have and those who have. So we have a black middle class and a black business class, which is exceptionally super rich. And this cannot be hidden from people's view. And this is what is causing the rage in South Africa: increasing unemployment, very high food inflation. So the level of wage repression has, over 20 years, has pushed down real wages in a very meaningful way. So when you combine that with the huge levels of corruption, and four of our nine provinces are paralyzed because of this level of corruption. And that's the only thing, I think, only time I have for China, and that is, you know, they shoot corrupt officials in China And maybe that's what we need to be doing in South Africa as well.
I can invite you all to see this very interesting film, and I think there will be a possibility to discuss with you tonight.
I'm not here to promote the film, but I am here to promote something.
Yeah, okay.
That really, the African National Congress, in my viewpoint, has been captured by the capitalist class in South Africa. It is no longer a progressive force in any such manner. And that is what we need to face up with. Because for many people in this room, they'd spent decades of their life fighting against apartheid. And we've ended up with a system which actually where our deputy president, our heroes of the past, are using the guns on the side of the capitalist class to mow down the very people who put them into power. And that's what we've got to face today. And it's a very tough question. And it's a very tough debate. And let's not pussyfoot around it and have the discussion.
Yeah. Would you be so nice to give the microphone to the lady behind you? It should work.
Thank you.
Would you be so nice to present yourself?
Sabine Grund, a freelance journalist in Berlin. I want to come to the other side of the coin that the previous speaker just mentioned. I remember in the BBC program Hard Talk, a few years ago, there was a British former diplomat or politician who admitted bluntly into the camera that we Brits did not keep our part of the bargain in Zimbabwe, and we keep blaming the Zimbabweans. So I wonder if you have been able to take up such statements. There may have been several. I just remember this single one. Has anybody else admitted to African former colonized countries that there is something to rectify in our relations? Second related part, I've recently heard about a new European Union initiative to finally look at what European mining companies have been doing in various countries and to start regulating on an EU level. I wonder if you have heard anything about this. I think the information must have been about 4 weeks or 2 months ago or so.
Okay, ich würde gerne erstmal auf Herrn Desai eingehen. Und auch nochmal daran erinnern, es gab letzte Woche im Parlament in Kapstadt einen Zwischenfall, wo es um eine Protestaktion gegen Präsident Zuma, wo Abgeordnete der Economic Freedom Fighter, die geführt werden von Julius Malema, dem ehemaligen Vorsitzenden des ANC-Jugendverbandes, wo Präsident Zuma eben eine Millionenverschwendung von Steuermitteln vorgeworfen wurde. Da haben dann die Volksvertreter in dieser aktuellen Fragestunde skandiert, zahl das Geld zurück. Es endete damit, dass das Parlament mehr oder weniger geräumt wurde. Und Präsident Zuma hat umgerechnet, ich glaube, es sind 18 Millionen Euro für Sicherheitsverbesserungen in seiner Privatresidenz ausgegeben. Und unter anderem wird da zitiert, dass ein Schwimmbecken, ein Amphitheater und ein Hühnerhof gebaut wurden. Und jetzt ist eben die Diskussion darum, war das berechtigt oder war es nicht berechtigt. Das ist so ein aktueller Vorwurf, der, glaube ich, die Öffentlichkeit in Südafrika sehr beschäftigt, das jetzt als Ergänzung. Und das ist ja sehr hart, was Herr Desai jetzt gesagt hat. Ist es zu schwarz-weiß oder muss sich der ANC mit diesem Vorwurf auseinandersetzen?
Well, just to maybe share my thoughts, I mean, you were commenting and making a contribution. And I agree with the core of your sentiments. And also, I mean, just to put things in perspective, I think at the macro political and economic level, things have changed for the better in South Africa. It is just that, you know, you can't compare the condition, or rather the political dispensation under the ANC with the political dispensation under a morally discredited regime of apartheid. We should not even draw such parallels. We should be concerned about our inability to move forward, to be forward-looking, and to achieve the dreams that many South Africans have. Now, the institutional decay in South Africa, in my view, is a reality, and I've highlighted some of the institutions that are suffering this, and Parliament is one of them. It's caught up in old archaic rules that are meaningless to ordinary citizens. Over the past few years, the crop of parliamentarians that we've had, their sole purpose is to defend the president, is to filibuster, and is to ensure as much as possible that there is no accountability, that those who hold power do not account. But we should also be mindful of the fact that the institutional decay does not begin with President Jacob Zuma. He's a caricature and perhaps the worst expression of it. But elements of it can be traced back under Nelson Mandela, because he was the president who presided over the arms deals, which has escalated in costs up to 60 billion rands. I mean, there's a story that Van Zylstrabbert tells of a tycoon in Johannesburg who wanted to be very close to the new political elite and didn't know how to be close. He's owner of some of the significant properties in South Africa, including the Saxon Hotel. And he persuaded Van Zylstrabbert post-apartheid to introduce him to some of, as he called it, the new lot. Please introduce me to the new lot. And one of the people he was introduced to was Nelson Mandela. And at the opening of the Saxon Hotel, when Mandela was giving a speech, he said, Mr. So-and-so is one of the powerful forces that brought apartheid to its knees, when that chap was never featured in the anti-apartheid struggles. So we should be mindful that of the fact that some of the things that we contend with were also present under Nelson Mandela, but not to as much extent. Also under Thabo Mbeki, we had a gradual erosion of accountability, because parliamentarians were overawed with him. They would not ask as forceful questions as they should, and he centralized power. He was philosopher king.
Mr. Kobo,
and
so
finally,
we
okay.
have to come to
okay,
the
sorry.
End. And Mrs. Gaza, I'm sure wants okay. to comment too.
Okay, just a final point. So, I think we should move away from the notion that it was a big bang. You know, this institutional decay. It's been coming, and also citizens have contributed to it, because they transferred power to political elites and thought and over-idealized people like Mandela and other leaders. Thanks.
Okay. Now, Mrs. Gaza, I think about 3 minutes.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I think that I'm very uncomfortable in saying, even as a figure of speech, shoot the corrupt people. I come from a very highly militarized society. I grew up in the streets that were burning with tires. Not even in casual speech do I want to use the language of militarization, because sooner rather than later it infiltrates into our psychology. And this is very important, particularly in the light of what we have seen in Parliament, and where the ministers of the security cluster coming together and saying a very tough decision has to be made in dealing with the EFF and disruptive elements. This is in the light also of when Parliament was in disarray, and in fact, the Speaker of Parliament was completely misbehaving, and police were called in, because what she was supposed to do was to prevail on the president. And this is where institutional decay comes in, to prevail on the president to answer the question to the satisfaction of the member, or to give a date where he would come and answer. Now, I happen in my previous life to have been part of a process that was trying to review the rules of Parliament. And I know which rules have been taken out, have been taken out, and which rules have again been reintroduced in order to protect hegemony. My final question, my final comment is that with all due respect to Van Zyl, I don't like these urban legends because they don't quite help us in understanding a society as it is. I was in Sweden when the arms deal was being negotiated. President Mandela, in fact, was pretty much in the dark about the arms deal. So was the ambassador in Sweden. So were so many other people. So it's very important that we try and you hear this everywhere. In America, you are told Mandela sold out and he was given so much amount of money for this, that, and the other. And for me, the issue is not to valorize Mandela. I don't think he was interested in that, actually. And that is not my interest. My interest is to try and find a narrative that explains where we are and how we got here. And yes, I believe that the problem started with President Mbeki. I believe that President Mbeki was shaping, others were calling him the prime minister. And there was a time, in fact, when the same caucus in parliament was behaving in the way that they are behaving in relation to President Zuma. But the question is always the leader himself, because you're not talking about a child who's not able to view and to ask what is going on. I think that the most critical issue that is facing us in South Africa is how best do we move forward? What is it that can be done with the constitutional framework that we have? Because what everybody is talking about, including the president, this assumption that land policy is going to change. We have a land summit that is coming back next week, that is going to be held next week. I can assure you, no change is going to come out of that because there's no political imagination, there's no political will, and there is a poverty of ethics. Where you have a poverty of ethics at the highest level in society, you are not going to have anything else. Lonmin is under spotlight, but there are so many other companies that involve the elite. It has become difficult to separate the state from the party and the party from capital. And that is where I would like to leave this conversation.
Thank you. Ganz, ganz, ganz vielen Dank an dieser Stelle an... Pardon. An Nombo Nisogasa und Musukisi, Entschuldigung, Kobo, für diese sehr differenzierte Diskussion. Auch für, danke für die Anregungen aus dem Publikum. Ich bitte um Entschuldigung, wir werden Ihre Frage mitnehmen müssen. Sie dürfen mich auch gerne nachher nochmal ansprechen, weil dieser Aspekt, den zweiten Aspekt mit den Minenkonzernen, das würde mich auch nochmal interessieren. Ich wollte eine Sache noch ergänzen. Jabulo Nebedele hat gestern Abend gesagt, wir bauten Häuser, aber wir versäumten, Gemeinden aufzubauen. Vielleicht ist das auch ein wichtiger Aspekt, den man heute, an dem heutigen Tag noch mal hinterfragen sollte. Ich möchte Sie ermuntern, diesen Tag zu begleiten, denn es kommt noch ganz, ganz viel, was wir diskutieren können, was wir aus dieser Diskussion aufgreifen können. Es gibt jetzt eine Pause und um 11.45 Uhr, ist das richtig, wird es dann also etwas später weitergehen, nämlich mit der Diskussion um Wahrheit und Gerechtigkeit und tatsächlich, wie hat es ein Land geschafft oder ist Versöhnung möglich nach so viel Grausamkeiten, die in Südafrika passiert sind? Ganz vielen Dank für Ihre Aufmerksamkeit an dieser Stelle und an die beiden auf dem Panel hier. Applaus